the body of one of the attackers. It was picked up on the runway at the airport. The autopsy categorically excludes an extraterrestrial being. His molecular structure clearly establishes him as a member of the human race.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Coming to you not from our downtown headquarters, but from a secret location, from a bunker not too far removed from downtown Toronto. It is episode 205, Alfred Hitchcock's 1972 murder mystery, Frenzy.
Yes, Chris and I have become survivalist whack jobs, and for some reason we feel that nuclear war is imminent, so we have decided to reside in a bunker for the foreseeable future.
Yep.
And
instead of trying to grow vegetables and try and survive a post-nuclear world, we're going to be resolute in our desire to keep broadcasting.
We're going to record podcasts.
That's what the people want. A scary thought.
when the bombs are bursting over our heads, and you know, the rock and red blares, the balls bursting in our ears, you and I will be talking about fucking,
God knows what, yeah.
But that's the way it is.
Hey, well, this is different now, because it's dun 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 Hitchcock.
Yes,
finally.
Our first Hitchcock.
Yeah, and we've made
200 episodes, and we have yet to discuss a Hitchcock film.
All we've done is made, you know, derisive comments about the Psycho remake, which was, you know, deserves as many derisive comments as you could possibly comment.
The ill-conceived Psycho remake, which was directed by Gus Van Sant. I remember seeing that
just
in the theaters opening weekend and just cringing. Vince Vaughn as opposed to Anthony Perkins. Anne Heche as opposed to Janet Leigh. And just Viggo Mortensen was in it, and he's a good actor. But I mean,
well, Gus Van Sant is terrific, and it fills you with kind of a part of your soul.
But why didn't you make a shot-for-shot remake of Psycho?
A shot-for-shot remake of anything?
It wasn't even a shot-for-shot remake, because then it started to diverge. And I remember when it came out, for some reason there was hype. People wanted to see this movie, and it did quite well on its opening weekend. It was number one, and then it just tanked. It was awful.
Well-deserved.
But we've also, we talked about Psycho 2, and so we've talked about Hitch a lot. But this is the first time we're actually delving into a Hitchcock movie, and amazingly enough, we're not choosing to start with, you know, your Birds, or your Psychos, or your North by Northwest, or your Verticals, or your Strangers on a Train, or your Rebeccas, or your Spellbounds, or your Notoriouses, or your Rear Windows, or your Rose. I mean, it goes on and on and on. We're actually going to talk about Frenzy, which is a film that came out in 1972, and it happened to be the penultimate film in the master's career. His last film was Family Plot, which came out in 76, and he passed away shortly thereafter. And not only is this the first Alfred Hitchcock film to ever explicitly show nudity, because some people think, because of the expert montage in Psycho, that there was some nudity.
There was
no nudity there.
No, it was created in the theater of your mind.
Indeed. Nudity. Bit of gore, not really, but for Hitchcock, yes. And there's a veneer of sordidness to this one. And it's also Hitch kind of going back to his roots, because it's his first film shot entirely in Britain since Stage Fright way back in 1950, so 22 years later, and he's back in jolly old England.
Mm-hmm.
And we start the film fantastically with this beautiful panoramic shot of London with this
Gorgeous
politician.
Yeah.
Going on and on at the banks of the Thames.
The Thames, yeah, right by Tower Bridge. This guy's just sounding off, bloviating about this rubbish, about cleaning up.
That was the word I wanted to use, by
the
way.
Oh, yeah.
I
think this has been going on for 1,000 years, but with however long the democracy's been around, like cleaning up the Thames. My God, they're still involved in this massive public works project to make this sewer tunnel and try and get rid of you know, the effluent that goes in there. So this guy's trying to do a photo op and saying, you know,
calling and I live by the river.
Yeah. Da, 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 da. Yeah, and this guy's trying to do a photo op and, like, in pure Hitch form, upends it and just takes this moment and, you know, disrupts it by having a body, wash up on the shore. And apparently, like, where we find out that there is a serial killer already on the loose. So this is not the first victim, because one of the attendees of the press conference points to the water and says, look, you know, a necktie. It must be another victim of the necktie killer. So we're set up with a killer roaming the streets of London, similar to Jack the Ripper.
But let's not gloss over what we see. We see a body wash up ashore in the nude. Right away we see nudity. This is completely, for Hitchcock, we're in very, very different territory. There was never any nudity in a Hitchcock film. She's got a necktie around her neck. She's asphyxiated. She's dead. It's something that I'm sure audiences at the time that were expecting, in most Hitchcock movies, the men all wore suits. Even this one too, but it's a bit more casual. And he was a master of suspense. He was not a horror director, even though some of his films are considered horror movies, like Psycho and the Birds. He directed suspense movies, thrillers, etc. This one, on the other hand, is Hitch having some fun with the new mores at the time. And actually, you know, the ability to be a bit more explicit in what he shows, the new permissiveness of the time. And so, yes, we have this killer, which is very loosely based on Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, I was going to say, they touch it off as to who the killer is quite quickly into the film, and it's Rusk, and that's a little nod to the epistolary Jack the Ripper dispatches to Scotland Yard, where he would say to the, I guess, chief of police, catch me if you can, Mr. Lusk, I want to say. So I think they substitute L for an R. But either way, there's someone on the prowl. And delicious way to begin this film, with a nice kind of gallows humor, and just, you know, a body washes up, and you're setting the scene just to perfection.
Actually, I think that's a wonderful adjective for the entire movie. It is delicious. Everything about this film is delicious. The characters are delicious. The dialogue is delicious. The gallows humor is delicious. Some of the shots are delicious. It's amazing. I mean, many people consider this to be lesser Hitchcock. In a lot of ways, it is, because this is a man. It's like the Rolling Stones. When you have a litany of historical classic records, and then you put out something as amazing as, let's say, Some Girls. I mean, that is a brilliant record, and yet you're like, oh, that's no XL on Main Street, or...
Yeah, or Tattoo You. Oh, yeah. That's no whatever, Beggar's Banquet. It's like you can only do so much.
So even lesser Hitchcock is still incredible. And this is by far one of the more unique films in his entire body of work, because beyond the fact that he's now showing nudity and a little bit more gore and even a rape scene. I mean, you know, you got to remember, Hitchcock was more than just a director. He was an institution. This is a man that was recognizable just by his silhouette. This was a man that had a TV series that ran a long-running TV series, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You were whistling the theme earlier. And so, audiences, I'm sure, at this point, were primed for that sort of Hitchcock, the more genteel, yet...
Restrained.
Genteel, yet, in his own way, suspenseful and scary. And when you saw that body wash up on the banks of the Thames, you're like, okay, this is totally new territory.
That's why he put himself in that scene.
We're talking about director cameos.
It's just like, you know, here I am too. And that must have shocked people right off the bat. And then, you know, kind of a winking presence. He's there at the bottom of the frame. And this is the new normal at this point of his career.
Right. And this is a very interesting movie, because Alfred Hitchcock, the sobriquet that's always been applied to him, is a master of suspense. This is a man who pretty much coined the term MacGuffin, the red herrings, what have you. This is a film that is devoid of suspense. Why is it devoid of suspense? Because there's a killer, and pretty much
we know who done it.
Proceedings, we know who done it. In the first third or so, we're maybe led to believe that, you know, one character maybe more, just based on his demeanor and his behavior and so on, might fit the profile more of the killer. But so is Scotland Yard. And so we have this character by the name of Blaney, Richard Blaney, or Dick to his friends. And he's a bit of a ne'er-do-well cad. He's a drinker. He's a gambler. He's a bit of a lout. He's down his luck.
Oh, man, and he misses out on this wonderful payoff. Like, what was it, a 20-to-1 shot at the track? Like, ah, damn. Like, typical schemer. Like, he loses his job and then tries to get a quick fix. Like, he's obviously a ne'er-do-well. He has no work ethic. He's just trying to go the easy way through life. Mm. And
then on the other hand, you have this gentleman who is sort of like the pillar of the community. This being the Russ character. Mm-hmm. And he's in the fruit industry.
He's a green grocer.
A
nod to Hitch's dad.
Yeah.
So it's a
and
new thing.
He's somebody who's jovial. He's even got his own little catchphrase, Bob.
Yeah.
And he's somebody who society would look upon as more of a respected figure. He's
pillar, not pilloried, if you will.
There you go. Mm. And it's not spoiling anything to say that the killer is actually Rusk. Mm-hmm. Rusk is a man who his veneer may be jovial and civilized and sophisticated, what have you, whereas Blaney's veneer is that of a scoundrel.
Yeah.
And yet, what is actually underneath that is Rusk is a man with deep, deep perversions. And these perversions need to be filled. And if they're not filled, he gets frustrated, and that leads to murder. So this sort of ties into Blaney, because Rusk and Blaney are friends, and Blaney has this ex-wife who now runs a matchmaking service.
And and so you can say he's a down on his luck character. His horse didn't come in, and he's barely making ends meet. I believe he stays in a Salvation Army at one point, which is like a Christian charity whatever. He's like, and complains about the BO on his stupid little detail on his suit jacket. And I reek. I stayed in a drop-in shelter for men. Like, I'm at my wit's end. I'm pathetic. This is bad. So he's got this, I would say salvageable relationship with the Mrs., who is a successful business person who runs a matchmaking service, and they apparently get along well enough that he can go to her and try and ask for help. And she's, they have this intense dinner date, and he brings it up that he needs money. She's fine with it, and so the two of them are how the two of them get along is what propels the narrative, because her secretary sees him leaving soon, I guess, around the time of her demise. This is the cornerstone of the whole film, is how Brenda Blaney meets her maker. And this was just a quite jarring, still to this day, protracted rape scene with this wonderful, like, centerpiece tracking. Is it a tracking shot? I don't know. It was the backing shot, because
it was backing away from her
business.
Was it her death when they used that wonderful tracking shot?
I think it was.
Okay,
yeah.
Because so we have the killer, we have Rusk, and I mentioned earlier that Rusk's path crosses with Brenda Blaney, and that's because he goes to her looking for a certain type of woman to fulfill his desires, and she basically says, "Look, dude, you're a pervert. Get the fuck out of here." And that pisses the shit out of him, and he ends up killing her. But earlier in the film, we actually see Rusk at work, where he's murdering a woman, and not just murdering her, but raping her as well, sexually assaulting her. And again, for Hitchcock, this is extremely uncharted territory. And as an audience, we are privy to viewing that. And what makes the second murder that we're privy to so much more effective is that we only needed to see it one time.
Mm-hmm.
Because we saw Rusk, we saw his MO, we saw the word he says before he starts flipping out and murdering, and I believe that word was lovely. And when it comes to his killing of Brenda Blaney,
lovely,
he mentions
lovely,
he says lovely,
yeah.
And we know what's going to happen. We know her fate. The camera pulls out, It tracked its way out the door of her office, down the stairs, to the streets where people are just going about their day, oblivious to the horror incarnate going on upstairs. And it's just, that is cool. That is
so cool.
That is awesome, because we as the audience almost feel complicit. In the sense of, we know what's going on, but nobody else does.
Yeah, yeah. The transition from silence to noise, from confines to daylight, and just, it was amazing, because typically in an urban setting, you think of someone on the prowl at night. You know, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, you're a maniac, you have all this gritty urban scenescape. This is Covent Garden, a bright sunny day, a rare one, in London. And this poor woman is being murdered in this place of her own business. And no one knows what is going on, and this guy just absconds into the street, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And this is happening amidst all this, you know, the daily comings and goings of a big city, and that was really weird. It probably was around 1 in the afternoon.
And then, as you mentioned, wrong place at the wrong time.
Hmm.
Blaney shows up.
Yeah, and they pin the murders on him because the secretary tips off the Scotland Yard, says, you know, the mustachioed hubby was there, and this guy's like a degenerate, and, you know, he would obviously have motive to kill her because they were on the outs, all that kind of stuff. Great stuff.
So what makes again this film quite interesting is we're invested in two characters for very different reasons. We're invested in Blaney because, well, he is the protagonist, but because he's wrongfully accused. But unlike most films where somebody's wrongfully accused of murder, and yet they're this saint, you know, this immaculate person.
This guy's far from beyond moral reproach. Yeah.
I like Blaney.
Me too.
I love his accent.
Great mustache.
I love his mustache. Yeah. I loved the way he would enunciate certain words, the way he would roll his R's, etc. But really, he's a ne'er-do-well cad, and he's not a likable character. On the other hand, Rusk is much more likable. And frankly, he's funny. Mm-hmm. He's a funny character. When he's not murdering, raping, and killing women, he's a guy that you want to go to the local pub with and, you know, have a pint or two. Then again, I wouldn't mind having a pint with Blaney either, but what have you. But it's interesting because we're investing in these two characters. We know the one is the murderer, and he is not. He's free, and the other one is not the murderer, and he is accused. And why are we invested? Because we want to see the guilty man punished, and we want to see the innocent man freed. But the dichotomy is that, for all intents and purposes, the guilty man, the pervert, the killer, the sexual deviant, etc., is the more likable of the two.
Just this film is just one fantastic set piece after another. I want to say it's the first victim. Apologies, it was a week since I watched this, but there was a victim. He stashes, because he's in the grocery business. He stashes the victim's body in a truck that's filled with potatoes. That's bound for Yorkshire or somewhere in the sticks.
Yeah.
And this was just terrific, as he realizes that he left a piece of incriminating evidence on the body, and he goes to try and find it. He finds it, and I believe, is it a brooch or a ring? It's a ring. And he pulls it off the, by now, rigor mortis deceased. And it was like kind of a neat, like that. I found that really jarring and kind of gross, and like the attention to detail of this guy. Like when he realizes it, it was a kind of a weird scene.
I gotta admit though, that scene kind of rang a little false with me, only because I appreciate the gallows humor.
Well, he had to break her finger to get the ring off. The rigor mortis had set in.
But
I was like,
before
ooh.
That, you know, the slapstick scenes of Rust rolling around in the potatoes and trying to maintain his balance.
Yeah.
I mean, this film had a lot more humor, I say that in quotes, than most Hitchcock films. The gallows humor was phenomenal. The woman running up, the woman washing up on the Thames, you know, to undercut the...
Yeah, the gravitas of this silly.
But that was a little, but you're right. I mean, the fact that you had to break your finger to get the ring, that was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think would have been quite surprising. And we are discussing in the green room before this podcast, as we're wont to do with our, you know, research there. We both have a similar approach to film because we were both hubristic, young, know-it-all you know, smug teens, and we thought movies that were made before a certain point were not worthy of visiting.
For me, it was 67. I read the book, yeah. Easy Riders, A Raging Bull. That's when, you know, cinema came into its own, the auteurs, etc. And that is when I figured anything made prior to, let's say, Easy Rider or Bonnie and Clyde was not worth my time.
Yeah, and what I felt similarly. So as someone who had grown up on Hitchcock.
Because now, I mean, I'll watch anything from, like, you know, I'll watch, like,
from the Lumiere brothers. Yeah. And I thought this was so ridiculous because I went through that phase after my parents, one of whom actually lived in London in Plumstead, where this was filmed nearby. I thought, okay, I went through this period where I was almost rebelling against my dad saying, Hitchcock is the master, this guy's brilliant. And then I was shunning all films made pre-1968, I think probably with Sam Peckinpah and the likes of Repulsion, all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, this, I'm going to be a snob. And then I came back to Hitchcock through our mutual friend Chris, high-powered lawyer friend.
We watched
it together and like, yeah, okay, lesser Hitchcock. And we watched it as like not lesser. This is
Frenzy.
Yeah. It was not lesser Hitchcock.
Well, it is. I mean, in the grand scheme of the man's career, this is lesser Hitchcock. I don't think anybody would put Frenzy in the top 10.
Maybe
best
top
Hitchcock
10,
films.
Like 8, 9, or 10.
It might just be, you know, number 11 or what have you. But it doesn't matter because, you know, even the worst Beatles song is, you know, way better than, let's say, the best Imagine Dragons song.
Yeah, for sure.
And this film, I mean, it may not be as broad or an accomplishment, if that's even a word, as, let's say, your North by Northwest or what have you, or your Verticals or your Rear Windows. It may not be as compact as Todd. There may be a little more comic relief than you might want, and some people may take offense to the excesses for Hitchcock of this film, but it's delicious, like you said earlier. It's got...
Delicious.
It's just like the grapes that... Rusk ever so thoughtfully gave to his down and out friend.
Yeah, exactly.
It's sweet and delicious.
Yeah.
So much
that's an excellent segue. Okay, it's funny you should mention the term delicious because we are actually drinking a kind of plum brandy. And I was thinking because I read
this was exported or imported, I don't know, did you get it yourself?
I believe I did. I brought it back from Hungary.
From my...
From your homeland.
My homeland. Yeah. Budapest, Hungary.
And
I'm enjoying it quite a bit. But
yeah,
anyway.
And I read... I was trying to think where, like, this guy got his gallows humor. And Hitchcock was famous, if not infamous, for his practical jokes, which ran the gamut from... benign to quite, I mean, really sinister.
Well,
so, like, on the one hand, like, what he liked to do was when he would get into
let's discuss the elephant in the room. As much as in today's society, post Weinstein, etc., we might have to call Hitch a little bit, quote unquote, I hate this word, problematic. And the reason is because he was notorious for abusing his actresses. Both, well, not really physically, but mentally on set. So, yes, he was not exactly the nicest guy on set. In fact, in The Disaster Artist, have you seen The Disaster Artist?
Yeah, not yet. I've seen it twice now.
When Tommy, talk about problematic, James Franco, more allegations.
Yeah, for sure.
When Tommy Wiseau is kind of losing his shit on set, and he's not being very nice to the actors, and he goes... Was Kubrick nice? Was Hitchcock nice?
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, Barbara Lee Hunt, who played Mrs. Blaney, had nothing but kind things to say about Hitch on the BBC, which jarred me because I had heard all these innuendo.
Yeah, exactly.
And why I'm mentioning brandy is that I didn't even want to get into the problematic, to use the vernacular,
The
au courant vernacular about how he treated women, but brandy, he actually, I think, spiked a drink with laxatives. And I remember reading this, I think I read his biography when I was maybe 17, and he did this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, to a cameraman or someone. He spiked their booze with laxative, and it was like our very, you know, drink of preference right now. And I thought, that is some sick... That is so deviant. I was going to mention
I did it when I was a kid, man. I gave someone a bar of Ex-Lax.
Oh, yeah.
I said, would you like some chocolate?
Oh, no. Okay, could dare I ask who? Is it someone I would know?
No, you don't know. It was, okay. It was like grade six or what have you.
God, my God.
Yeah, I didn't see him for the rest of the day, that's for sure. But anyhow.
But what, like on a less problematic note, I thought it was very funny. One of his practical jokes was that he would also get into a lift, get into an elevator and start telling this incredibly compelling, bombastic, interesting story. And it would be so captivating that everyone around him would be, you know, listening in. And then when he got to his floor, when you would expect the punchline, the denouement, mm-hmm. he would end the story and go about his day and leave people hanging, you know, in the elevator. I thought, this guy is really a wonderful character. You know, I would have loved to have met him, and I thought, this is like, these are the two extremes, the kind of pranks he would pull. And I thought, man, okay, maybe I'm surprised that you were priming people with laxatives, you sick fuck.
No,
but okay, in your defense, you were 16 or 17.
Because on our last podcast, the excrement came up when I was talking about, yeah, see, that was payback, that was karmic payback,
exactly.
When I did to that poor kid. Mm. Oh, I remember his face. I don't remember his name.
Oh, my God.
Man, it was bad. I know.
Oh.
Anyway. But when you mentioned food, I thought you were going to talk about the inspector.
Well, yes. I was going to get to that.
There,
I don't know. I was very befuddled by this because this inspector who's Mrs., is making him these like cordon bleu, like weirdo dishes that he would just like an English breakfast or whatever, like, you know, sausages and eggs and whatever. And she's making him this stuff like, you know, Marco Pierre White, Gordon Ramsay kind of, you know, 4-star French
just
dishes.
Fish soup.
Yeah.
The head of the fish, you know, very Julia Child-esque.
Yeah, and I don't know what the purpose of this was. It seemed vaguely xenophobic. I don't know. Does everyone hate the French? I don't know. I thought it was just me because I'm Italian. Like, I thought it was weird because, yeah, like all these dishes
like
were
double take when you said that.
Well, yeah,
I know
it's
the
like,
Italians hate the French, but anyway.
You're born to hate the French if you're Italian. Yeah, like there's a weird cultural one-upmanship that you're trying to do because they have, I hate to say this, they have better wine. I hate to say it. And then Italy may be more fun, but yeah, there was a nasty war between the two. But I thought, like, what is the point of this kind of, like, what was that, what was the function of that? Because the inspector's Mrs. is an interesting character because she has a lot more insights into the human condition than the inspector. She knows that Blaney is not the man on whom these murders should be pinned. She doesn't see it right from the get-go, and she almost convinces her spouse that he's not the guy for it. She says it's a different temperament or someone who would, this is not him.
I'm just laughing right now because I it just popped in my head when another inspector came by, and as any proper British housewife would do, she offered him a drink, and she goes, it's a margarita.
Margarita.
And it was something so exotic to them.
Yeah, not a gin and tonic or anything.
Yeah, or just a beer. You know?
Or a shandy or whatever. Yeah.
And so they were not very appreciative of her hospitality. But I mean, this is a delicious film. I mean, it really is. It's fun. It's a fun movie. It's, once again, the penultimate film of an absolute cinematic master. It may not be up there with his Stone Cold classics, but it's well worth the viewing. So I'm just going to give him my star rating, and then I'll go into what I learned. Because
there's
not much I learned.
We can swap them, yeah.
So my star rating for this film, you know what? 4 stars for me.
Yeah, likewise.
I loved it. This was not my first viewing of this film.
You were spellbound.
I was spellbound. And every time I've seen Frenzy, I've just enjoyed the heck out of it. It may not be the best Hitchcock, but like I said before, it doesn't matter because the worst Hitchcock is better than the best director, Michael Bay, whatever the fuck you want. So I can't believe I can put them in the same sentence. Mm. Your star rating.
Oh yeah, 4 as well. It really holds up. Like there's a few pacing issues. It was a little bit protracted, but not even necessarily because it could just mean that we're just, I think running time has been shaved by Like, I would love to get the data on this. Average running time. We know that dialogue is nowhere near as fulsome as it once was, 20, 30 years hence. But I would love to know average running time for the average mainstream release. This felt a little long, but it could just mean it's just me. So what did you learn then?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, just doing my crack research, as I always do before we discuss a film. The Rusk role. I'm ashamed to say I forget the name of the actor that actually played Rusk, but it was initially offered to Michael Caine. And Michael Caine turned down the role because he thought that both the script and the film, and the script and the character, Rusk, were reprehensible and disgusting. And so he turned it down, which is hilarious.
It is hilarious, that infamous story of Michael Caine and how he accepted roles.
But there was that, but I was thinking, because I'm just thinking, like, you know, a scant 8 years later in 1980, he's in Body Double, Brian De Palma, infamous Hitchcock...
knockoff.
Yeah. You know, influence, whatever, you know, I mean, people say a ripoff, but I love Brian De Palma, but, you know, in Body Double, he's playing a... cross-dressing serial killer,
exactly.
And that was disgusting to him. Yeah. But, you know, Bob Frankel was disgusting to Mr. Michael Caine. Mm-hmm. How did he select roles?
Oh, well, there's that famous story about how if he appeared on the first page and then on the last, then he would take it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was the, you know, that was his M.O. Yeah. So, I don't know how, if that was just, you know...
Well, this is a man that appeared in Jaws 4, The Revenge, and, you know, I don't know, I mean...
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Who knows?
What did you learn?
I also learned that, my God, you gotta have better security at these hospitals where inmates are staying. This is repeatedly we see this in horror films, where someone will bust out of an asylum, and most famously, I guess Michael Myers, right? But when I think Blaney, if I'm not mistaken, he fakes. Some sort of injury or something to get himself out of prison because he's in prison. They've deemed him like they've got him dead to rights and he's jailed and he manages to get himself into hospital and then out. I think he adopts the guise of a surgeon, if I'm not mistaken. Someone creates a diversion and he puts on like a scrubs and he just walks out the front door and like, come on. Like, get your security detail right. So, yeah, 4-star, both of us.
Our next Hitchcock should be a mutual fear of ours, Rope. We really
That would be great. And we hope you check out our website as well, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. And follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. Send us, because this is our first Hitch, send us your favorite Hitch film and the one you think we should really discuss next. If it's not going to be Rope or Rear Window or The Trouble with Harry or any of North by Northwest, any of the classic films. reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.